This is When Orla Met, a conversation with and about some of the leading athletes, engaging brains and fascinating characters in sport. A huge thanks to Twist Teas for sponsoring this podcast. Their 24/7 tea is what gets me through the day, an Indian Assam and Kenyan black tea blend, perfect for morning or afternoon. So brew yourself a cup of Twist Teas and enjoy When Orla Met. Lizzie Deignan is one of the most successful professional cyclists the UK has ever produced and one of the biggest names of her sport in the world. A world champion on the road and track, Commonwealth champion and Olympic medalist. But Lizzie's ride over the past few years has been anything but smooth. Before the Rio Olympics, it emerged she had been suspended from her sport for missing three anti-doping tests within 12 months. The Court of Arbitration for Sport cleared her, ruling that one of the missed tests was a filing error and another the fault of the anti-doping officer for not trying hard enough to find her, even though she was exactly where she said she'd be. That left one missed test, a result of Lizzie not updating her whereabouts on the official system. She and her now husband had flown at the last minute to Ireland, where his father was dying. With the leaking of the story, despite having been cleared in court, and the fact she didn't want to discuss her dying father-in-law, led to her being vilified by a doping-weary media. Today, Lizzie Deignan is in a much happier place. Pregnant with her and her husband's first child, she's looking ahead to the next Olympic Games in Tokyo with a very different perspective. This is When Orla Met Lizzie Deignan. Lizzie, thank you so much for sitting down to chat. How's the pregnancy going, first of all?
So far, so good, yeah. The first 12 weeks were a real struggle, but I think I'm through that kind of hard phase and I'm meant to be in the glowing phase. I'm not sure I'm quite glowing, but I'm enjoying it, definitely.
Are you enjoying the pregnancy? Because psychologically, it's a massive change as well as physically. Are you adapting to that quite well?
Yeah, but it's strange because you get used to something and then the next day you're totally different again. So it's like this constant kind of change and challenge. And I feel a bit vulnerable. I definitely feel like the baby's in charge already, which I didn't expect to feel so soon. So yeah, I'm kind of baby-led at the moment, I suppose.
Because that's one thing I remember from my pregnancy, exactly that, the vulnerability. And for me, I remember thinking that I was seeing the world slightly differently and my place in it slightly differently. Instead of having to forge your own single path, I find that being pregnant seems to attract a sort of protectiveness in some way, and that people care for you at the same time as you're caring for the baby inside you. Do you find that? Do you find that you're looking at the world with a little bit of a softer vision than before?
Maybe. I mean, I don't know if I've just always been very maternal anyway. I remember even as a teenager, I've always saved money, which is really funny, but I've always saved for my future with a vision to saving for my family, even at that age. So I think I've always been kind of preparing for motherhood in a way. And in terms of people being protective of me, yes, they do. Yeah, they are. And I kind of have to settle into that a little bit. I'm struggling with that sometimes, definitely, when, you know, people carrying my suitcase upstairs.
I did offer. Sorry, but I feel I have to.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's nice, isn't it? And it is a nice period in life, and I should learn to enjoy that, definitely.
But that is quite difficult, isn't it? Whenever, I mean, you are a professional bike rider, and so there is so much about your job that demands you to be very tough and very aggressive. And you have to sort of settle into allowing people to look after you. That is quite a shift for most people, never mind someone in your job.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose I'm just stubborn. I will always be stubborn. And I use it when it suits me. You know, there's a priority queue in the Carrefour supermarket near where we live. And I've been using that. So they keep asking me, are you pregnant? And I'm like, yep. So, you know, I'm using the advantages when they come.
And how are you finding it physically then? Because a professional athlete, you're used to controlling your body and being the one in charge, and your body is the tool of your trade. It's won you Olympic medals, world championships. But now your body is doing what it wants to do. Is that difficult to get used to?
Yeah, very much so. I've always coached myself, so I've always kind of been very in touch with how my body's responding to things, and I react according to that. So now with training, I'm just reacting to the baby, essentially. Like, there's days where I try and pedal a bike and it's like, you know, almost like the baby's laughing at me. Like, what are you trying to do today? Go home. So I'm just very responsive to what they want. And actually, I'm quite comfortable with that because, you know, it's not everybody's lucky enough to have a child. And I just feel so grateful and so lucky that I do, that I'm just so keen to do everything I can possible to make sure that the baby's healthy. And, you know, my mum said to me, every sign of pregnancy is a sign of a strong pregnancy. So embrace it and go with it. So I'm trying to do that.
Is there a liberation to not being in control, or not being the one solely responsible for being in control, if you know what I mean?
Yes, I think so, yeah. It makes me look back with, I suppose, yeah, it gives me a different perspective, definitely. That I think when I return to cycling, I will have a whole new perspective on it. But just the fact that it's okay to not be in control, and just kind of trust the process a little bit. And I just fascinated by how intelligent our bodies are, you know, like what we are actually capable of. Just kind of have to trust the process a bit.
So you say you always wanted to be a mother, and yet you've gone into a profession which isn't necessarily very conducive to producing large families. Was it a difficult decision for you to decide when might be the right time to start a family?
I always thought that having a family would be after my career. And it's only when you suddenly become 29 and you're married and you're the oldest person in the team, you're the experienced person in the team, and it happens quickly. And your mindset doesn't actually, mine hasn't changed. I'm still ambitious and I'm still focused and still determined. So it doesn't mean the finish line that I thought it meant. Rather than, you know, it stopping my career, I've seen it as an opportunity to prolong my career. And I think I've found myself in a position, you know, happily married and in a financial situation where I can do it, which I never really thought I'd be able to. So that's why we've decided to, you know, move things forward, I suppose.
What was that moment like then when you discovered that you were pregnant? Was it, oh, great, it's happened, or, oh, God, what are we doing?
No, it was the best feeling ever. The best feeling I've ever had, definitely. I've just always wanted to be a mum. And like I say, it doesn't happen for everyone. And I've always been very aware of that. And, you know, I've never been ignorant to that fact. And, yeah, we were both just like, oh, wow, you know, we've done it.
So what about looking ahead to when the baby's born? And there are so many variables, there are so many unknowns, but presumably plans of some sort are in place. How do you foresee juggling your life with a baby in the future?
Just that, juggling it. You know, sometimes I've been frustrated, particularly in recent years, that my life is so one-dimensional and it's very cycling focused. And that works for a certain amount of time, but the becomes a point where that's not enough anymore either, and our lives are going to be so busy and so full. But it's a two-year project essentially until the Olympic Games, so I think we can both get our head around the fact that we're going to be busy for 2 years, and it's worth the challenge. We see it as an adventure, I suppose, and it's definitely a we, you know. I think that's something that perhaps people underestimate as well. You know, I'm not doing this alone. Physically, I'm going through 9 months of change, but after that, it's both hands on deck, definitely.
Because your husband, Phil, is a professional cyclist as well with Team Sky. Any chance that his career would take a bit of a backseat so he'd be a stay-at-home dad?
You never know, yeah. I mean, he's going to be 35 this year and he's had a very successful career. So if that happened, then I'm sure he would embrace it as well, yeah.
I read somewhere that you said there's been a mixed reaction among the peloton as to your news, and that some people said you were crazy. Is that right? I mean, what have people been saying?
I think it in the peloton and in general, for me, there's kind of been this divide, very clear divide, of people thinking, wow, cool, what an adventure, and people potentially thinking, are you crazy or are you being selfish? And I suppose my own views over time have changed as well. If you'd asked me 5 years ago, I probably would have thought, well, why would you try and continue cycling? Why don't you be happy being a full-time mum And yeah, with age and understanding and your own perspective on things, you realise that if you are capable of doing both and you want to do both, then, you know, there shouldn't be judgment either way, really. I think it should be whatever you want as a family, you should be able to do it without fear of judgment. And yeah, going to go for it.
So in what sense selfish then? Where does that come from? Trying to have it all, or?
I think the fact that, you know, inevitably there will be nights away from my baby. And I think people, yeah, I've had judgment for that. I think that people are sort of saying, well, how are you going to leave your child? And I'm like, well, in the same way that Philip will, you know, in the same way that plenty of parents do. I think I'm capable of loving my child and having a career. I'm capable of that easily. Like,
and in many ways, it can also make a career more important, in the sense that there is something to be riding for, there's something to be achieving for. You've got a greater sense of purpose, really, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. You know, listening to both my mum and my sister, they felt a definite sense of confidence and strength and empowerment from becoming a mother. So I'm hoping that I feel the same, yeah.
Have you found much of the judgment? I mean, I find that whenever you're expecting a child, people feel that they have the right and almost a responsibility to tell you what they think about how you should be living your life or living your pregnancy or whatever it might be. Have you suffered from much of that?
Yeah, I think I've probably had more advice in the last 6 weeks than I ever have before. But, you know, you try and look at the positives and think that people are, you know, they're only trying to give you a little piece of advice. And you, like anything in the past, cyclists have always given me advice, and I take the bits that I think are good and ignore the bits that I don't. So,
and I guess in a way it's quite a nice leveler, isn't it? Because what you do is you live in such a rarefied world to a certain extent, and you do things that most of your friends and family probably who don't ride bikes professionally can't understand. And yet becoming pregnant, having a family is something that if people are lucky enough to want it and have it, that anybody will go through. So it's a leveler, I guess, as I say.
Yeah, I find it funny. In the start, people were so shocked and so surprised. And it was a shock for me to see their surprise and shock, because without really understanding or knowing, I'd become a cyclist in their head. And that was it. That was me, you know. And I, that is what I should be doing and should be focusing on. And the kind of personal aspect of who I was, I think, had, you know, some people had forgotten that. And it was nice to be able to kind of say, well, no, this is, you know, I have my own choices, personal choices, as well as professional ones.
In that sense, how far do you think we've come when we look at women trying to juggle having a career and having a baby? I think we like to think that the world is much more open to be able to juggle both, but maybe it's not quite as open to that as we think. As you say, people tend to put you in a box. Either you're going to be a mother or you're going to have a career.
Yeah, I don't think we're close enough yet. But I think, you know, the world can be kind of like a business, you know, the business world can have sort of a short-term perspective on things. And in my mind, a woman's value, if they are on maternity leave for 3 months, 9 months, a year, it's such a short period of time, and it doesn't devalue what they're capable of doing professionally. It's just, you know, it's simply a couple of months. And it's a bit, for me, about kind of people being a bit more open-minded to the fact that that person of value has started a family, but, it shouldn't affect them professionally.
And there are studies that have shown that women after pregnancy can actually come back physically stronger than before. Their rib cages expand, so you have more lung capacity, their hearts change, and lots of hormonal changes as well. Have you been looking into any of that and taking solace from any of that?
Yeah, I'm actually sort of least concerned about the physical aspect of it. I'm most concerned about, you know, managing and juggling our busy lives that are going to suddenly happen. But physically, I think, like, right now, I feel healthier than I've ever felt in my life. I think it's probably going to be a good thing to have a year off professional sport. You know, I'm still keeping fit and active, but I'm not totally knackered and feeling like a zombie, which I started to feel like the last year or two. So I'm hoping that it kind of is a revival, yeah.
Because is it fair to say you've maybe fallen, maybe not out of love with cycling over the past few years, but it's not been that all-consuming passion that it once was?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, post-Rio was very difficult. 2017 was a year that I was just kind of going through the motions. And I'm actually really proud that I got through it, because I was pretty miserable when it came to bike riding. But my, you know, I'm still able to perform and I was still getting results. Standing on a start line, not really being bothered about the result at the finish line, but still managing to do something in that race for a teammate. I found solace in working for a teammate, to be honest, last year, because it meant that I was still fulfilling my professional obligations to the team. And I suppose my, yeah, conscientiousness and work ethic got me through training. But if you're not passionate and really wanting it, you don't sprint 5 seconds longer than you should in an interval. You do just enough.
So what was it that changed then? Was it the whole incident before the Rio Olympics when news emerged of the three missed tests? Is that, and all the furore around that, all the fuss around that, was that the catalyst for a bit of a change in your attitude to the sport?
I think any athlete post-Olympics has kind of a tough period, because you've worked so hard for, you know, for something, and then it's kind of whether you achieve it or not, actually you still have that kind of post-Olympic blues. But yeah, 100% it was down to just a very tough time personally for me and my family, and also publicly it was, yeah, it was a tough thing to go through. And I thought, well, I didn't really want the limelight. I didn't want to win races. I didn't want to have to speak to journalists after the race. I just wanted to, yeah, keep my head down and go home.
Because for those listening who maybe don't know what happened or don't remember what happened, it's well documented in your book, Steadfast, where you had an incident of three missed tests, but it had gone to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. They ruled in your favour because one of the tests wasn't essentially a missed test. It was an anti-doping officer who didn't try hard enough to find you. You were where you said you would be. And so you had that whole ordeal to go through in terms of the legal side of things, to try to put to one side. And then before you went to Rio, the news broke and it took on a life of its own, and it became, I guess, associated with suspicion and with headlines that linked it to the doping situation in Russia at the time. What was that whole period like for you? But do you look back on it now and see it in different stages? For example, the Court of Arbitration for Sport period, and then the it becoming public period, or how do you look at it now?
I suppose it's still a blur. I mean, it was, yeah, again, it was reported as three missed tests. Actually, it was one missed test, a filing failure, and a missed test that was the fault of UK Anti-Doping. And I felt really let down by UK Anti-Doping at the time that they didn't publicly defend the fact that, despite the fact, you know, I was tested within a day of both missed tests, and obviously, you know, all my samples have proved negative. I've never doped. And they, to my mind, should know and understand that I'm a clean athlete. And I understand that athletes have to be under a rigorous system. But all I needed was for them to say, we've made a mistake. We're an organisation that's totally funded to do this job. And we've made a mistake as an athlete, as an individual. She's made a mistake, but it's not a doping mistake, and that would have just changed it for me, you know, but they didn't. And yeah, it was just horrendous, just to be kind of your character kind of assassinated publicly. It just reflected on me, the way I was brought up, my family, you know. It was just, to be called a cheat publicly when you've done nothing wrong is hard to go through, yeah.
And especially since you were held in such high regard, you were the first medalist for Team GB of the London Games. I hate to use the term, but a bit of a poster girl, if you like, for British cycling, which is not something you ever asked for, or from what I could tell, necessarily entertained. It was something that was thrust upon you. But that switch must have been very difficult to deal with.
Yeah, I suppose I was fortunate in a sense that I never really bought into that. So that was something that happened as a process of results, etc. But it never really changed my outlook on why I was doing it. You know, I've always wanted to win races because for me it's like athlete versus athlete, finish line. It's not the stuff that comes after it. It's not reading my name in a magazine, etc. But that doesn't change the fact that reading your name next to a doping headline is very painful. So I was lucky that, yeah, it, in terms of, yeah, my identity, it didn't change who I thought I'd become or anything like that.
Do you still feel let down by UK anti-doping? Do you feel like they've done anything to atone for what, I guess, the grievance?
No, I don't think so. I think that the system is still massively underperforming. You know, there's still so many times where I try and update my whereabouts where the Adams system is down, where I can't even upload my data. And yet, if I make a filing mistake, I am taken to court. And, you know, financially, it costs me a serious amount of money that not many athletes will be able to pay. Yet, you know, they haven't taken ownership or apologised or anything. And, you know, you're still working with a system that essentially is not even good, you know. So, no, I don't think so. I think there's a long way to go for them to be transparent themselves, actually.
Have you spoken to them about that?
No.
Would you care to? Is it something that... That you would like to resolve within them in terms of making the system better, making it more efficient for athletes, so that other people aren't caught up in it in the way that you were?
No, not right now. I think my priority is, you know, me, my family, and just making sure that absolutely everything I can possibly do, emails, phone calls, texts, etc. It's, you know, I'm covering myself three times over in every address update that I do, and that's all I can do, really. I don't feel that I would have a voice that would change anything.
Before we continue, I want to take a quick tea break to say a huge thanks to Twist Teas for supporting this podcast, because there's nothing like a chat and a cup of tea to lift the spirits. Twist Teas have a range of 24 different blends with or without caffeine. So whether you're looking for a morning pick-me-up or an afternoon soother, you're bound to find a tea to suit. You can pick from their classic blend to peppermint with a hint of chocolate, or functional herbs to give you a boost. Have a look. There really is a blend to suit pretty much every mood, or you can suggest blends of your own. Go to their website, twist-teas.co.uk. So what about when that story broke then? Because as I say, you'd already dealt with it all, and again, the emotional turmoil that came with it, and probably thinking that was it, done and dusted, you'd cleared your name and it was all fine. And then the newspapers break the story. And as I say, it came at the time when we were learning about the level of doping within, state-sponsored Russian doping. Mm. And so it was a very hot topic at that time. How was that particular period for you?
I suppose it was enlightening for me that I realised how naive I was before. I thought that if you'd read something in a newspaper, you could trust it. And actually, you can't. I mean, opinions are stated as fact all the time. You can try and get a redaction from a newspaper from something that's false, but it'll cost you a lot of money and it'll just be a small line at the bottom of a newspaper article. So it was enlightening for us as a family to kind of see how the media worked, you know, the dark side of the media, essentially. And it made me conscious of the fact that, you know, I used to read stuff and believe in it, and you would never, ever see me spend a single penny on a magazine or a tabloid or anything now. I just, you know, it's, for me, it's just, I have no trust in it. I don't believe a single thing that I read in those sort of things. And it also made me realise that celebrities, people that you can so quickly judge, are actually people. Potentially going through very difficult things behind closed doors. And, you know, I suppose it sort of softened my approach to judging other people. Yeah.
I remember you releasing your statement shortly after the news broke, and it was just before you were getting on the flight to Rio. And so that's, like, I think from memory, about an 11-hour flight. So you'd released your statement. We, as the media, had the chance to digest it and obviously comment on it. And everybody had their say on social media and other platforms before you landed. What was that flight like, knowing that that was probably happening around you and that you weren't able to either monitor it or control it in any way?
At that point, I was just physically exhausted, emotionally exhausted. I slept for quite a long time, actually, for the first time in weeks. Just because, at that point, it was out of my hands, really, and how public and media reacted. I have limited kind of ownership of anymore. So I suppose I'd managed to put myself in a mindset where I thought, I've written my statement, I'm turning my phone off. You know, I didn't look at anything from that point on because it was just damaging. And I just thought, right, I'm at the Olympic Games. I've fought really hard to be here. I've trained and sacrificed everything to be here. So I'm not going to let my family down now. And that's what I tried to do. But, I mean, I didn't achieve it, but I tried to.
So I remember seeing you shortly after you got off that flight. You gave a small number of interviews. And I remember so clearly waiting on that rooftop on Copacabana Beach, waiting for you and wondering what to expect. I've come to know you as quite a tough character. Mm-hmm. And so I expected you to come along and be quite defensive and a bit feisty and a bit, here's my side of the story. And I believe in myself and everybody else should. And what I saw was just you completely threw me. Mm-hmm. Because I felt like I was looking at a broken woman. Essentially, it was really emotional to see. How did you feel addressing the media and sitting down and talking to people at that time?
I felt just very vulnerable. I mean, I was walking to those interviews with two bodyguards mm-hmm, through the centre mm-hmm. of Rio. I landed off the plane to paparazzi. You know, I was shuffled out the back door into a van with blacked out windows. It wasn't how I'd ever envisaged my Olympic journey going. And I think it was just, you know, there were personal reasons why I missed the test that I did miss. And I was being asked about it. And I just thought, I don't want to talk about my family. I don't want to tell people why I was going through a hard time. And I was being pushed to. And I was just like, it was just very difficult because people then jumped to their own conclusions, and I didn't feel that I had to explain myself from, you know, the family situation. So, you felt like anything you said would be interpreted wrong. So it was very kind of every word that came out of my mouth, I was thinking, you know, I was trying to kind of say the right thing, but then when you're doing that, you inevitably end up saying the wrong thing. And I should have just being myself, but I just felt that whatever myself was at that time wasn't good enough, a good enough explanation for people.
And what was the reaction like amongst your fellow riders at the start line? I mean, from memory, there was a bit of a mixed reaction. Some people saying she's been cleared, her name has been cleared, it's fine. Others, like the French rider, Pauline Ferrand-Prévot, saying that you shouldn't have been there, and if you were Russian, you would have been kicked out already. So what was the personal interaction you had with any of the riders?
Again, I think teammates, people who knew me personally, who'd raced with me, who knew my character, were supportive. But also in their own Olympic bubble, they're on the start line of the Olympic Games, they're not going to offer me support. There was one rider in particular who came up to me in the race, touched me on the back and said, I'm so happy you're here, you deserve it, which was very touching in an Olympic Games. So, I focused on that rather than anybody else. And it made me realise that you have to kind of know the full story before you give a judgment. And it's difficult to know the full story.
So how did you recover from all of that then psychologically? Have you properly recovered from it all? It's something that I think, most of us are lucky enough to never have to go through, have that very public battering. I can't really imagine how you get through that and put that all to bed, really.
Because you don't let the good overrun the bad. You know, it's for me, I can look in the mirror. I'm proud of who I am. I'm proud of the moral compass I have, the way I've been brought up. And it would be wrong of me to quit and to let, you know, something so negative change a career that I've worked really hard for. So, yeah, I'd say it took me a good year to kind of fully get over it. I don't think I'll ever kind of feel good about what happened, but it taught me a lot. And I think, you know, for me and Phil, we went through just a horrendous year together, and we got through it, and kind of think we'll throw anything at us now, you know, we'll be all right.
Well, that's the thing, because they do say what doesn't break you makes you stronger. Is there anything from that whole period that you can, in a strange way, be grateful for, having survived it, having gone through it, and having learned particular lessons from it?
I think, yeah, I mean, you can't control what everyone's going to think of you, and that's particularly when you're in the public eye and you have people have a snapshot of you and they make a very quick judgment of you. I mean, it's a natural human process, and rather than kind of focus on trying to please everybody, as long as I'm living my life the way I feel is good, and, you know, I'm doing the best I can to be honest and hardworking and a good friend, a good sister, a good wife, then that is far more important than what somebody reading a tabloid thinks, isn't it?
Did you ever think of quitting through that whole phase, walking away from the sport?
I probably did, yeah. I probably did think about that, but never truly entertained it, just because it would have been throwing away something that I'd worked so hard for. So, no, I didn't go down that road very far. Mm.
You say that you're still not convinced that this system is entirely fair. As we sit here talking, the Chris Froome situation is as yet unresolved. He still has an adverse analytical finding hanging over his head. He's trying to clear his name, saying that he didn't exceed the permitted dosage of salbutamol. In cases like that, and you won't be privy to the details of it, and the case that's ongoing. But how confident can you be as a fellow bike rider, as a fellow athlete, that he will, and others like him, have a fair process at least, and go through the due legal fair process?
Well, he hasn't had a fair process because already people have made up their minds, unfortunately. And that is based on not the full story. You know, none of us have the full facts of the case. But unfortunately for Chris, his reputation is tarnished and will be forever. Whether he's innocent or not, it's kind of irrelevant to some people at this stage. And that's because, you know, a leak in a legal process should never happen. A rider should be protected, because inevitably there will be things that happen, grey areas that should be looked at logically, scientifically, and analysed in court, because that's an inevitable part, I suppose, of, you know, having asthma and taking an inhaler. And I think, yeah, unfortunately he hasn't had a fair process.
Do you think that we lose the humanity of it slightly? Do you think that we're so desperate for a black and white, for a guilty or not guilty, that we just don't want to take the time to see the nuances of it? Do you think that we forget that there is a human person behind all of this, and they might have a very individual story to tell?
I think, yeah, that does happen, yeah. And I suppose, for me personally, I can see it as a very personal story and understand that it's a very personal thing that's happening to him right now. So that's why I would reserve any judgment on it until the courts have made up their mind.
Looking back in your particular experience, and we're talking about you now being pregnant and a new phase in your life, in a way, was that whole time of your life a bit of a catalyst for now having a baby during your career, not waiting until the end, given that it made you fall out of love a little bit with cycling, and here you are doing something that you didn't necessarily expect to do, having a baby before the end of your career?
I suppose there was a realization that it's my career and I shouldn't be doing anything to make anybody else happy, because, like I said, I can't keep everybody happy. So yeah, I suppose it did enable me to kind of become more focused on what makes me and Phil happy, definitely.
You've talked about it maybe being able to give you a greater sense of balance afterwards. In what way do you seek balance?
I think because cycling is so time consuming, and, you know, we live in France, we live in this bubble away from friends and family, and you have to be successful, but kind of adding a little special baby to our bubble, I think will be very special, and I think we'll feel very lucky that we can kind of enjoy 2 years of time where we can just about manage it.
Do you think it will change what you define as success?
I'm not sure. No, I think a lot of people have sort of said you'll have no idea how you're going to feel when you have a baby. And that's true. Personally, I have no idea how I'm going to feel. I've never been through that process before, but I'm totally confident that my determination and ability to focus and kind of steadfastness will still be there. I still feel that my character as Lizzie will still be there, even though I'm going to become a mum. And I find it kind of patronising sometimes that people suggest that it won't be. And I'm like, well, I'm capable of loving like a mum and doing this as well. So I'm excited about it. I'm excited about the learning process of it, definitely.
We come back to that thing again, don't we, of this unwanted guidance or advice or whatever it might be. Everybody who goes through it seems to think that their experience is the only experience that there will be, and you will learn.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, fair enough as well. You know, I should probably kind of accept the fact that I've never done this before, and it is totally a new journey. But I take everything with a pinch of salt and see what I think.
Even though you say you will do it completely your own way, have you sought any guidance from those who've done it before? Laura Kenny, Sarah Story. There aren't very many female cyclists who've come back and ridden successfully, competitively on the bike.
No, they were both lovely when I announced the news of pregnancy. They both got in touch and, you know, both expressed the fact that it will be difficult, but and there'll be plenty of people who tell you it's not possible, but it is. And it's, you know, Laura said it was the greatest feeling and it gave her a real love of cycling back. So, you know, hopefully I'm the same.
What kind of a mum do you think you're going to be?
I think I know what kind of dad Philip's going to be.
Which is?
He's going to be the softie. Yeah, definitely. I don't know. I think I've had a great upbringing. I really respect the way my mum brought me up. She kind of pushed us to all be quite independent, but with enough love. I intend on spoiling the baby with love, but maybe not other things. We'll see. I say that now and then you'll see her like pulling a load of toys around.
I remember reading before, this is maybe from a year or two ago, that if you ever had a little girl, you would encourage her to get into tennis and not cycling. Is that still the case?
Oh, I think I said that, yeah, because in terms of equality, you know, tennis, they're really, you know, pushing the boundaries there, which is great. But no, I don't know what I'd want my daughter to be, whatever she, as choosy as it sounds, whatever makes her happy.
We feel like, it seems like we're in a period of change when it comes to women and equality and whatnot. What kind of a world do you think you're bringing your baby into in that respect?
I hope a world where they are not limited by their sex, whether they're a boy or a girl, that they see opportunities everywhere and aren't limited by their gender. I think we are getting there, definitely. But, you know, I hope they look back at their mum and think, oh, you know, proud of her for being one of those people who push those boundaries, because you do need people to push those boundaries, and we still do. We're still, you know, a long way off. But I think we're at a point now where you kind of publicly, people can't get away with being sexist. So whether they're sexist behind closed doors or not, it's kind of irrelevant, because publicly that's not acceptable anymore. And I think the next generation, that'll be reflective.
Because you have been someone who, again, not necessarily invited it, not asked for it, or even necessarily embraced it, but you've been a bit of a spokesperson, I guess, for equality in cycling. And however reluctantly you've taken on that role model position, do you feel that becoming a mother will make you stronger in that in any way? Do you feel that you will develop, I don't know, I guess there's a responsibility to your next generation, isn't there?
Yeah, I already feel that, actually. Yeah, I feel much more comfortable talking about equality now that I'm going to be a mum. I'm not sure exactly why. I just think that it's so important. And I suppose I feel like a fully fledged adult now. I'm taken seriously and push for those things. I'd find it very difficult to hold back on any feelings I had. You know, I'm not going to be a pushover or a walkover, and you need people not to be. If I can be one of those people, then I think I should be proud of it rather than kind of reluctant. But it is sometimes difficult. It's not an easy thing to do. You face a lot of criticism for it, but needs to be done.
You and Phil live in Monaco at the moment. Do you intend to bring your child up there? Or I know you've bought a house in Yorkshire. Where do you see, you're talking about the next 2 years, for example, of your career. After that, 2021, from then on, what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, at the moment we're planning on staying where we are because of how good it is for cycling. I think having a baby will be, like I say, a big enough challenge without having to face the Yorkshire rain every day, etc. So we'll stay there, stay in our little cycling bubble for another 2 years, and then the plan is to move back to Yorkshire. Yeah, I think we'll miss the sunshine, and that'll be that'll be another challenge. But that's the plan at the moment.
How much of your pregnancy do you plan to keep active for? I remember Laura Kenny, fellow cyclist, having to defend herself for exercising right up until the end. Again, it's that unsolicited advice thing, I guess. How active do you plan to be through this?
I think it's so personal, and that is what I've discovered with pregnancy and reading up on it, you know, coaching myself. There's so many different types of advice. I think pregnancy in general, the advice changes every year, mm-hmm. what you should, shouldn't eat. And I suppose I'm reluctant to tell people too much because I think I would not want a woman who's pregnant and really struggling to read my interview or whatever and see that I'm riding my bike 3 hours a day and she's thinking, well, I can hardly walk up the stairs. You know, I think it's so individual, and I personally will exercise as long as I can. I've been a professional athlete for 15 years. I know my body really well, and I feel actually a lot better when I've exercised. I think the baby likes it. I think I will take day by day, really, rather than kind of, you know, it's impossible to plan a week's training. It's totally how I feel. So as long as I can.
How have your team been with it? Publicly, they've said your position on the team is still open. You can ride for them once you come back from maternity leave. Maternity leave, that doesn't really exist in professional sports,
not
does
yet,
it?
No. But
how was that experience telling them, and how have they been?
They've been very good, yeah. I told them as early as I felt I could. They've been very supportive. Whether I stay with Bowls going forwards, I'm not sure yet. I think it's important for me to sort of take this time to reflect on what's the best option for me in terms of, you know, how I come back. I think I will need a team that's kind of very supportive of the fact that I'm going to be a mum and facing new challenges, and whether that's with Bowls or with someone else, I'm not sure at the moment. But I've made some great friends there, and they've been a great team for me, so I'm very grateful for the career I've had with them.
Are you aware of you're going through this visibly, I guess, because you are in the public eye. Are you aware of other pregnant women looking at you and maybe looking to you for an example? I mean, I remember when I was pregnant, I was obsessed with every famous person who was pregnant and comparing their lifestyle and mine. And then when they had the baby, well, how do they juggle this, that and the other? Do you want to be an example to people, a role model in some way? Or is that something that you might be a bit reluctant to do?
I would like to be an example in the fact that I would want people to look at me and see that there are no limitations, that they should, if they have a dream, they should follow it and dream big, because I think that as a woman now in 2018, it's 2018, isn't it?
It still is.
It's
okay, you've got baby brain.
I'm thinking in 2019 so much at the moment. I thought my credit card was out of date the other day. Yeah, we're capable of having it all, you know? And why not? Why not strive for it? The worst that can happen is you'll fail, but at least you've tried. And if I can encourage somebody to have the confidence to do that, then I think that's a good thing, yeah.
Lizzie, thank you so much for your time. Thank you. Best of luck with everything.
Thank you. I'll need it.
It was wonderful to hear Lizzie's optimism and determination about juggling impending motherhood and the rest of her riding career. It's funny how we're still told, as women at least, that you can't have it all. I guess no one can really, but if what you want as a woman is to have a successful career as well as children, then I'm delighted Lizzie Dignan is happy to be that role model for the rest of us. Men don't need those shining examples. Maybe one day women won't either. Coming up in the next episode, when Orla met Mark Cavendish.
I knew he would achieve because he always, even at school, if Mark wanted to be top of the class, Mark would always be top of the class. He always...
had to wait.
Even after I was successful as a professional, that it was the only place in the world that I could come back and just be... Mark, I could just be me. I wasn't Mark Cavendish, like.
That's in the next episode of When Orla Met. A huge thank you to Jonathan Rowe for doing such a great job editing this episode. And as well, of course, to Twist Teas for introducing me to peppermint and cocoa tea. And of course, for sponsoring this podcast. If you have any thoughts on anything you've heard so far, do drop me a line at orla@whenorlamet.com. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram as well, @whenorlamet. I'd be delighted if you left me a review on iTunes. And if you've missed any of my chats so far with Sarah P. McCoy, Pippi York, Judy Murray or Maggie Alfonsi, you can download them right now. And of course, you can subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any future episodes of When Orla Met.